Okay, be honest. Have you ever sat down with your morning coffee, fully convinced you're about to conquer the world, and then somehow found yourself scrolling, snacking, alphabetizing your inbox, and wondering why your brain feels like it's running dial-up internet? If that feels a little too relatable, listen up. Everyday Dose is coffee with benefits. It's the same delicious coffee you already love, plus lion's mane, collagen protein, chaga, and nootropics to help support focus, mood, and mental clarity. Imagine your morning cup not just waking you up, but helping your brain fire on all cylinders without the jitters, without the crash, and without the sudden urge to reorganize your sock drawer. And because the collagen is built right in, you're supporting smoother joints, stronger hair and nails, and healthier looking skin, all at the same time. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high quality coffee with powerful ingredients like lion's mane, chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit, free peppermint mocha creamer plus for the holidays, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/mindful or use code MINDFUL at checkout. This holiday season, what does comfort look like to you? To me, it's slowing down and embracing the shorter days by allowing myself more rest. A curated space allowing for the best sleep I can get is the cornerstone of this process. Avocado Green Mattress makes this possible with everything from breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses. Create your natural holiday oasis with avocado products. You can transform your home into a peaceful, grounding retreat and provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Plus, avocado mattresses and bedding are made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
We overeat and we overemphasize how much we need to eat. And I think we overemphasize the amount of nutrition the body needs to function. And the reason why I say that is because I fasted for 30 days.
Yeah, that's
So
crazy.
it's very hard to tell me that over X amount of days or whatever, you're not gonna be able to function. Not
Right.
only did I do very long fast. I mentioned to you earlier, I'm in Texas, and when I was doing my primary fasting, I'm an electrician. We're working outside, we're on the roof, it's summertime. You
That's
know, I'm
crazy.
working in schools. When you work in a school in the summer, there's no AC. They're not gonna run the AC and nobody's there. So I'm in dusty areas. I was in very poor environments. And I'm fasting, and sometimes I'm dry fasting. And
Yeah, that's insane.
I'm up and down ladders, I'm hauling pipe. So I was able to perform and function at a level that you would think you shouldn't be able to. I should have
Yeah.
fell over, but it was fine.
Chris James, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Les. I appreciate it.
So you're a holistic wellness coach. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's what I refer to myself as.
Okay. It seems like you have a real niche that you focus on around fasting and like the healing benefits of fasting.
Right. So, fasting was one of the main tools that I personally used to improve my own health, and so that was one of the tools I taught, and people really flocked to it. It's like one of those natural things that we really don't use anymore, but it's something I think humankind has used since the dawn of time, really.
Gotcha. Yeah, some intentionally and some probably not so much.
Yeah, definitely. But our bodies are adapted to it. So it's actually to a point, and I think science is showing us now, it's to a point where it's beneficial. We overeat a lot now.
So I also have a little experience with fasting. I haven't done it in a while, but there was a phase of my life that I got into it quite a bit. What brought you to it? You said it helped with your own health. Were you dealing with something? And then that was like a important part of the healing stage?
For sure. Yeah. So like when I was 28, that is when I noticed like my body was starting to fall apart. You know, hair was thinning, my memory, cognitive function was declining. And at lunchtime after I would eat, you know, I was construction. At lunchtime I would get really tired and literally fall asleep on the construction site. So I knew some crazy things were going on because I'm like, these are like 40 plus year old problems that I'm having in my late 20s. And I just felt like, even though it wasn't anything crazy, it wasn't like I had cancer or lung disease or something, I felt like these problems were going to turn into bigger problems later. And I just wanted to address it.
So what did it do for you? Like, what did that look like as far as how you used it back then? And what did you accomplish with it?
So the my first fast. Okay, so first of all, now if we're going back over 10 years, I didn't understand fasting. No one taught me this stuff. I learned everything on my own. So my friend had actually challenged me to do a month of eating vegetarian only. He was like, I had never eaten vegetarian. He had been a vegetarian for like years. And so I finally was like, okay, I'm gonna try this. So I did a month of vegetarian only, and I noticed that I lost weight. I wasn't trying to lose weight. I've always been kind of slim, but like my love handle started to shrink, and I felt great. My energy levels went up. And so the next natural progression for me was going into fasting, because it was like I was studying, you know, natural healing and different, you know, diets, and fasting was like something people were talking about. So my first fast, I wanted to do what I call the Jesus fast, which is a 40-day fast. And I actually ended up doing 13 days of water only. And what I noticed was instantly I noticed that I was losing about 2 pounds per day, which was crazy. Obviously I mentioned to you, my cognitive function was a major issue. After 4 or 5 days, I got this euphoric feeling where I just felt like I wanted to be healthy. I wanted to be active. I had a really good outlook on life. It was weird. It was like I had taken a drug that just makes you like giddy and happy. And, I was like, how can I feel this way? You know, 4 or 5 days into a fast. Like that should be the opposite of what I should experience based on what we're told, right? You need food, you need nourishment, and you need all these things. There was an infection that I had been dealing with for a decade at that time. And like the doctors, you know, nobody could tell me what it was. Everybody was like, oh, it's in your head. You know, they just kept prescribing me different medications. And by day two of the fast, I had noticed that the irritation that I felt had gone away completely.
Was this like an intestinal infection?
It was in my urethra.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was just one of those things where like the doctors were like, we've tested you for everything. We've given you everything. They really thought that, I think they thought that I was like imagining it at some point. But the last time I went to the doctor, he was like, hey man, maybe it's your diet. Maybe your diet is having an impact. And it was in perfect alignment with what I had been researching and studying at the time. And so when I started to fast and I started to get relief, I was like, okay, it's gotta be something I'm eating. Like, you know, and so that's when I started to really play with my diet as well.
Funny, like when you're looking at all the interventions and things you could try, one of the, I guess, beautiful like simplicities of fasting is there's nothing really to do. You actually get to do less than what you're used to doing.
That is a beautiful thing. Yeah. I tell people, you know, most strategies, therapies, whatever, they cost something, you know, whereas with fasting, you actually save money because, you know, the average person is spending $200-$300 a week on food, especially if you're door dashing. And, we don't think about how much money we spend on food. I think it's actually one of the reasons why people have so much financial problems, because they spend a ton of money on food. We don't cook at home, right? I mean, most families are eating out, and they say, oh, you know, we go to the McDonald's dollar menu, but it's like, you can't beat just going to the produce section, buying a bag of beans or some quinoa, you know, some bell peppers or whatever, go get you a nice cut of meat or whatever the case may be, you can't beat it, because you could eat off of that for days. And so this is an opportunity to save money. And like what I tell people too is you can actually gamify it. It's like, figure out how much money you spend on food every week. And then for every day that you fast, you could just literally break down how much money that you've saved, and then go take yourself on a trip or buy a laptop or a purse or whatever. So it's fasting can be very fun if you allow it to be.
Right. But eventually you do have to eat. I know there's that one case from back in the day where the guy went, I want to say it was like over a year on a water fast. I think it was in a hospital setting. I'm not sure. And it was crazy. I mean, transformation. You know, I don't know how much we understand of like where the line is for each individual of what's appropriate or what's too much. I think at one point I was doing too much of it, and I think I lost too much weight. And I think there's a lot of stress. Like you mentioned that you felt euphoric, and I have definitely done different dietary things, and some of them have produced like that euphoria. And also, I think that's stress hormones. Like, stress hormones could feel euphoric. Like, people like going on, I mean, I don't, but people like roller coasters, you know? Like, they like the cortisol, the adrenaline. I don't, and I think there's, it's amazing that our body has these systems that it can tap into, because you do still need to make energy when you're not eating. So, and I think a lot of that's modulated or regulated by our stress hormones. And it's great that they can do it. At the same time, you can't do it forever. Like, you don't want to be driven by stress forever, no matter how good it feels. You mentioned briefly, I forget the context, but I think when you were talking about what you were dealing with and you said you weren't dealing with cancer, I remember looking at some of your content to prepare for this. And you had, I guess, showcased like this, I guess, analogy between, I think it was like a tribe in Africa and cancer, and it was beautiful. Yeah. Can you, I don't remember the details, but if I assume you do, can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. So, the actual name of the tribe, I don't recall it. I think the Bohem or something like that tribe, but basically when somebody in their culture does something negative, so this could be robbing, this could be, I think even like murder, or, you know, I don't know if there's limitations to it, but basically when someone does something that we might send them to jail for here, instead of punishing them in that way, sending them to jail or even, you know, some type of unaliving, what they do is they encase the perpetrator with the community, goes around them in a circle, because everybody knows them, right? And they actually speak life. They speak love. So their belief is that when you're doing something wrong, when you're kind of acting out or however you want to look at it, it's because you don't feel loved, because you don't feel valued, because you don't feel seen. So they feel responsible, and they're like, oh, we haven't been taking care of our brother. And so they speak life into them. And I just thought that was the most beautiful thing. And then I thought about our bodies, because my grandmother was the first person who actually taught me about natural health. And so long ago, 25, 30 years ago, she told me, when you get a tumor, the tumor is actually the tumor itself is healthy cells, right? So you've got the mutated cells that are on the inside, but they're kind of encased by healthy cells. And I thought about the tribe and the you know, what the body does, and really what the body's doing is it's protecting the rest of your organs and systems from these mutated cells so they don't spread. And it's just a really beautiful thing that the body does. And I think it's great that some of us as human beings, we mimic that.
Yeah, that is interesting. It seems like, I mean, I've heard doctors talk about how you could go around with a cancerous tumor for a really long time. And if it doesn't spread, just be fine. Just kind of go on with your life. I've even heard people say, like, there's a risk in getting a tumor. Like, if you have a lump or tumor, there's risk in poking around. Like biopsies could potentially, like, let's say it is a protective field that your body is creating on your behalf. Like, you might not want to penetrate that and break that up and let, you know, facilitate the whatever's on the inside to coming out.
Yeah. Well, you've got benign tumors, which are, you know, pretty popular. I dated a girl that had a tumor in her brain, which used to freak me out. You know what I mean? Just hearing that. She's alive and well, has children and everything. So, you know, it wasn't cancerous, but it's like, you don't want to mess with it, because you know how sometimes you hear stories about people that get like bullets lodged in their head and,
right.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, it was inches away from killing them, but it just got stopped. And then it's in such a sensitive place where the doctors don't want to go in and extract it, 'cause it's like, it's really dangerous. So I kind of look at it like that. Yeah, I mean, the science isn't really going to tell you that if you biopsy that you're going to spread it. But we tend to see when we talk to people who have had these types of procedures done, we just tend to see it as an anecdotal thing. It can spread. But I mean, if you understand what the tumor is and what it's doing, it makes sense. So, you know, you penetrate it, and even though it's only a small needle hole, I mean, how big's a cell? It can go right through those holes, and then it starts to spread. So, yeah.
I also notice in your content, I think you kind of document at least a few people that, that have gone on some type of healing journey with cancer and attribute some fasting protocol to helping that process along. What do you think's going on there?
Autophagy, in a word, if we were going to, you know, one word, autophagy. Autophagy, so like when you think about what cancer cells are, you know, they're just normal cells that have, you know, maybe they've become inflamed and they have a buildup of cellular waste. And then the cellular waste starts to degrade the cell and mutate the cell. And if you don't clean the medium that the cell is in, which is the blood, then it continues to contaminate and it just spreads. And so when you utilize fasting, after about 16 hours or so, the body begins to go through this process of autophagy, which basically just means it's called self-eating, but it basically means that it breaks down those mutated cells. It clears the waste. Anything that can get reused, it'll reuse, and the rest just gets discarded. So it's a really beautiful process of renewing the body and the cells. You get better energy production. A lot of people don't understand that your low energy may actually be because you have a lot of inflamed cells. Because if in order to get energy, you've got to get water, or I should say hydration, into the cell. And if we're living with all this inflammation, we're drinking bulk water. So the you know, when you talk about your filtered water and your bottled waters, these are bulk water. It just means that the molecule of the water has a big bulky head. And the cell is inflamed, so it's swollen. And it's hard to get those two to kind of, you know, interact. So if we can break up those water clusters and make them smaller and easier to penetrate the cell, then the cell can, you know, release the waste and the inflammation, and you'll see that healing. And through that process of getting the water into the cells, the cell extracts that hydrogen and uses it to generate energy. You know, it's called ATP. And so when we deal with low energy,
the cell uses hydrogen to make ATP, or it uses the oxygen in it?
Hydrogen. Yeah.
It uses. Where does hydrogen come into play there? Do you know, or like how that, are you familiar with like the actual metabolic pathway or whatever in the cell where that goes on, or
no?
Just keep it general. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not.
What about autophagy? I mean, I've heard about that for a long time, and I think when I was fasting, I had that on my mind back in the day. Do you know if that's like measurable now? Is there like a biomarker that's used to see? Like, I remember hearing people say that, yeah, after 16 or 18 hours that goes on. I think it always is going on to some degree, but I guess at some point it increases. Do you know if that's something that can be measured now and they're looking at?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's any tools that we could use, like a keto strip or something like that, where you can like measure autophagy. The way that I measure it is through observations of the body. So I understand what autophagy is doing. And then we just simply, you know, look at the different markers that we've identified, you know, as it relates to either weight loss or detoxification.
And like, what do you use for that other than, I guess, the scale, the number on the scale? Or,
well, I have one of my affiliate partners, they have a scale. It's one of the scales that give you like all these different metrics. It's called a body pod. So it's kind of like a home version of like a DEXA scan, where okay. you can get like all these different data points, and you know,
just
you
standing on it.
Well, it you stand on it, but then it also has a grip as well, so it allows for more accurate readings. Because most of those scales, they have the little pads on the bottom, so when you stand on it, it'll measure from your feet, but it's only measuring a small percentage of the entire body. When you grab it with your hands as well, it gets like almost like a complete circuit, and you get more accurate readings. They don't compare it exactly to, you know, like a DEXA scan, but as far as what I'm familiar with, it's as close as it gets as it relates to something you could purchase at home that's fairly affordable, right? But yeah, you just look at the body holistically, and you know, what does your water levels look like, or your hydration levels? What are your inflammation in the body? You can monitor the BMI, and you know, there's different data points, and just understanding what autophagy does, you can then, once again, this is just our observations, you can kind of see when it kicks in. But like, to your point, it's always happening. Most of these processes are happening. The body is super dynamic. So it's not as if, you know, people always ask me, Chris, you know, one of the things that we talk about, like if you fast for 14 days by day, if you fast for 21 days, from days 14 to 21, you get what I call hyperautophagy, which is where autophagy ramps up. You can tell that it's working much more dramatically than it does if you were doing like a 1 or 2 day fast, because you can see inches melt off your body in moments.
Well, your body at that point, if you're taking in zero food, I mean, your body's every molecule of ATP, everything that's being done is relying on the ATP that you're making from your own body. I mean, you're literally ripping the walls down to feed the fire at that point.
That's definitely one way to look at it. But here's the thing. When we observe from days 14 to 21, we see, first of all, the body stops losing weight, which makes no sense. So most people either see no weight loss, they might see like a half a pound or a pound over the whole week, or sometimes they'll actually gain weight. We've seen that happen many times. And then...
Wait a second, hold on. You're saying that somebody doesn't eat, and on day 14, from day 14, the third week, you've seen people gain weight.
Yeah.
So I assume they're drinking a lot of water. Must be gaining water weight.
Well, I mean,
that must be what that is, or?
You know, we're drinking, so we usually recommend a minimum of 90 ounces a day when you're cleansing anyway. So you're doing the 90 ounces, and you've been doing that up until day 14, you know? Usually people start to drink less water because, you know, you start to feel more hydrated. So people naturally will drink less, but you're losing 2 pounds a day on average up to day 14. And then on day 14, from day 14 to day 21, like your weight loss stops. And then
But you're consuming more than 2 pounds of water, so your body's holding on to some of that. These numbers are crazy, Chris. I mean, I did a bunch of fasting. Like, I used to fast. For a while, I was fasting, like, a day a week, and then I would periodically do two. And I tried to do three once, and I remember not feeling good. Like, I remember getting up and feeling basically unsafe. I was getting, like, tinnitus, and it was – it didn't feel health supportive. And granted, maybe I didn't have the reserves at the time. I was really lean at that time. I mean, I'm like 208 now. And in the peak of my fasting experimentation, like I think I got down to like mid 150s, which is probably 20 pounds below than I should be at minimum.
But
like when I hear 14 days, and I've heard people say it gets easier. Like you get to a point where it's not hard anymore. But it sounds crazy. Like it sounds like that is too big of a mountain to approach, I would think, for most people.
I think, well, it really depends on how you approach it. So one of the unique things about my community is that I've taken a really bold approach. I host large fasting challenges. So we've got people aging, you know, from the age range of, let's say, 18 to, I think one of our oldest participants was like 74, maybe even older. These are just the ones that I'm aware of. They will do a 21-day fast. But in order to do that, we do 2 weeks of preparation. So a lot of times when people fast, they're just like, hey, I heard about this fasting thing. I want to try it out. They just start. Or even worse, they'll do the last meal where they'll go and they'll overindulge because they're like, well, I'm going to fast for the next X amount of days. Let me, you know, kind of get it in while I can. And both of those are terrible ways to approach fasting, especially when we're doing the longer stuff. So we focus on the liver, first of all, when we do our 21 days, because when you just think about what fasting's doing. The body, okay, so you're releasing weight, the fat stores, there's toxins and contaminants in those fat stores. So if fasting allows you to kind of like put that back into the bloodstream so that it can be sifted through by the liver, well, what happens when your liver's low functioning or your elimination pathways are clogged because of inflammation or, you know, whatever? So that's where a lot of people see the really intense detox symptoms is not properly preparing. So we'll do a liver cleanse first, and then we do some controlled eating. We cut out breakfast because one of the issues people really have with fasting, especially the early days, is hunger pangs. So,
well, that makes sense.
Like hunger pangs and cravings. So what we start to do is control how frequently we eat. And then we also look at the density of the food we eat. Because if we can control the frequency and the density of the food leading up to our fast, the body adapts very quickly. And then you don't get the ghrelin spikes. Because that's what's making you feel hungry is the ghrelin spikes. The body is used to eating at, you know, 9 a.m., 11 a.m., 3 you know, PM, 6 PM,
whenever you're used to.
Whenever. So we basically shrink that down over the course of this 2 weeks to the point where you're really just consuming food, you know, maybe once or twice a day at most, and nothing in between, right? No snacks, no nuts, no gum, no soft drinks, nothing like that. So now you don't get all the crazy ghrelin spikes. So when you go into your fasting, it's a much easier transition. And then the other thing we do that I think is
really important. So you're basically losing weight going into it. You're not like I watched that what is the show? Alone. You know the show Alone?
Alone, just alone? Alone in the dark?
Or just no, like, just alone. They like drop people, you know, like in these crazy areas, and there's like 10 people. They're all by themselves, and they get, I don't know, about 10 items, and it's like who could survive the longest.
Oh, okay.
But most of them, you know, the people that have like high metabolisms or already thin, like they are at a huge disadvantage. Like people will prepare to like bulk up because it's hard to get enough food. And that's, you know, the primary thing which determines how long you last. But you're saying you guys do the opposite. So you're like cutting intake down, probably as a natural function of reducing the time that you're eating and restricting that time, you're like eating less to prepare to eat nothing.
Right. Like, think about it like this. I call it building your fasting muscle. When you go to the gym for the first time, you never just pick up 100 pounds and lift it over your head, right? You want to stretch first. You want to warm up. And then you want to maybe start with 20 pounds. And you get used to the range of motion, make sure that you're doing the movement properly, and you kind of build up to it. And so what we're doing is essentially doing that with our fasting muscle, because the body is used to eating, it's used to digesting, and you're used to all of the cues and everything you get. One of the things that I learned was, you know, like when the stomach grumbles, it's like, oh, okay, I'm hungry. It's like, no, your body's just digesting. It's the intestines are cleansing. And we, just based on like pop culture, you know, you watch the Looney Tunes, you see the grumbling signs, and they tell you that means hunger. No one ever taught you that that meant your intestinal tract was cleaning.
You know that? What do you mean? I mean, I've experienced that. What do you mean it means it's cleaning? I know that when I'm hungry, I can get hunger pangs. You're saying they're not hunger pangs?
Well, I guess for all intents, like it's hunger pangs is what, like, that's what we feel. That's what we, okay. So grilling spikes, it's a fluid that the body will use to help aid in digestion.
Ghrelin is a hormone, right?
Right. And it uses it to aid in digestion, but it does it in preparation for digestion, not as a result of a lack of nutrition. It's the body. Okay. You've got their circadian rhythm, right? So the body is on a clock. The body knows that it's 9 PM or 11 AM and you always eat at 9 PM or 11 AM. So in order to prepare for you're going to eat, it starts to prepare. It's a prep thing that it does. And the reason why I know this is because when we change our eating habits, especially over the duration of a week or even 2 weeks, you stop getting those quote-unquote hunger pangs at the same times. They start to adjust based on... So, like, I used to work with this... I used to be in construction, and there was this guy who was maybe 10 years older than me. And when you're in construction, you have your cell phone on you, but you don't really... Like, we're working. You don't really want to have too much stuff on you. So we didn't really keep... And I didn't wear a watch. So we didn't keep stuff on us. But, like... Maybe 15 minutes before it was lunchtime or break, he would always be like, all right, Chris, let's get ready to pack up. You know, it's about time to eat. And I would be like, how do you know it's time to eat? Like, how do you do that? And he's like, my stomach tells me. And I'm like, okay. And so I just started to learn that the body, it knows what time it is. And so when I started to adjust when I typically would eat, the ghrelin spikes would change as well. So now, I was 10 years ago, I'm just the standard American diet. I'm eating 3 times a day, snacks in between. I'm always eating. And then I went through my fasting period and I was doing alkaline food. And then it felt very natural to do one meal a day after 5 months of fasting on and off. So that's what I did. And now I don't eat like it's, you know, I haven't eaten today. I won't eat probably until 5 or 6 o'clock.
Do you generally just eat once a day then? Or?
It depends. You could look at it as once a day. I'm not in that space anymore where I just eat one square meal. What I do now is I'll eat, there may be like a 2-hour window where I will eat after a certain time. So it's usually like between like 6 and 8 o'clock. I'll eat in a 2-hour window, you know.
You mentioned also in the preparation that you do like a liver detoxification to prepare, because I guess your body, when you are liberating a bunch of fat tissue to make energy, fat, I guess, is one of the tools our body uses to store some toxins to kind of hide it, I guess, maybe from our immune system or whatever. And you run that risk of releasing it and kind of retoxifying yourself or getting a heavy dose. What do you do? What's your process for a liver detox in preparation for a fast?
So I do the Andreas Amazing Liver and Gallbladder Flush. That's okay. the There's many different ones. I think they're pretty similar based on what I've seen. But basically, it's a week-long preparation. It's technically a five-day prep, and then on day six, you do the actual flush.
That's the one with, like, the malic acid or something to prepare, and you don't eat fat, and then you have a heavy dose of fat and Epsom salt to just, like, relax everything and let loose in the toilet.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you? I've never done that. I'm a little scared of that. What do you experience from that? Have you moved like gallstones from that?
All right. There's a lot of controversy around this. All right. Most people, especially early on, they're not going to see what you would probably classify as a gallstone. What comes out is what I call bile stones. It's basically a mixture of mucus, plaque, bile fluid, because it's green, and just material that's in the liver. Because the liver has all these little spider webs looking tubes, and it starts to, when you take the olive oil, because it's olive oil and like grapefruit juice, that's what like activates it.
Right.
And you feel your liver pulsing. So it's literally I kind of look at it like how you squeeze the toothpaste out. It like pulses and squeezes, and all this stuff gets dumped into your colon. And
well, that dose of fat gets the gallbladder to squeeze. Like that, I guess fat is the signal to tell your gallbladder to contract.
You're talking about the olive oil.
Right.
Oh, okay. I guess.
I assume that's why that's in that process to get it. So it's been like kind of hoarding bile by not eating fat for several days, and then you give a big dose to ensure that you get that big contraction.
You got it. Yeah. You don't want to have any fat leading up to it. There's like a couple of days before you stop eating fat. Yeah. So you're storing all the bile fluid. And so these little green stones come, they're not hard. They're more, are you familiar with tonsil stones at all?
I've seen like salivary stones. Is that the same thing? I guess. I don't know.
Possibly. I've never heard it called that, but they're not.
So they're basically like cholesterol or fat coagulated with bile.
Basically. There's plaque, and there's also mucus in there, and just more like small particulates of stuff that might get, you know, trapped in the liver.
What do you feel though? Like, what's that? When I asked you how do you experience that, I didn't actually even mean like what comes out. I mean like, how do you, like, what does that do for you? Like, you feel like someone turns on the lights inside or something, or is it like misery and you feel gross because you're moving out, like moving this toxic sludge through your body?
So it's hard to describe. When you actually do the flush itself, it's kind of like you have diarrhea. So that's how the flush feels. But after the flush, it's weird. You can feel your liver. It's very, very, like, if you can't feel your liver, it's hard to really imagine. Like, when I started doing these flushes and I started doing different diets and fasting, it's like I could feel different organs. And so my liver can give me feedback in real time now, whereas before it was very dull. Like if I drink some really hard liquor, my liver would literally like ache. Like I could feel it overworking. It's so I get more attuned. And then also what I learned from using these flushes is it's very hard to gain weight back when you do them the way the book, because Andreas has a whole book, and you're supposed to do them until you stop seeing these stones come out. But you literally, like, when your liver is high functioning, it's very hard to gain weight. So for a lot of people who deal with weight gain, right? Like, we talk about fasting, we talk about the weight loss, that's great, but it's the yo-yo that people get on. They get that yo-yo or that roller coaster effect where they gain it all back. When you have a high functioning liver, it's very hard for that to happen. I'm personal experience. So,
do you ever do like before and after readings on like maybe like thyroid, like metabolism based markers, like thyroid levels or like bone density. I mean, you mentioned a DEXA scan and like a proxy for a DEXA scan, but have you had any, like I've heard people discuss this that, and I think there are experiments where you don't get enough food. Like if you restrict calories at first, for some people, it might be beneficial for the metabolism, but over time, it like slows metabolism. Like your body is trying to adjust the thermostat because there's less coming in and such.
Mm.
Have you yourself or had any of your people kind of do before and after where they check what fasting does to like thyroid levels?
I personally have not done before and afters. I've never really been big on personally getting the test done. And the reason why is because when I started to learn about fasting, I was not reading any books. I wasn't, there was no guidance. It was literally all about my personal experience. It was the anecdotal experience. And I actually really value being able to extract my own data and you know, my mind is not, I haven't been taught anything. I don't know any better. So everything I see and experience is purely what I see and experience.
Intuition.
Well, it's just firsthand observations.
But yeah, I think that's really important. And I think a lot of people kind of poo-poo anecdotal evidence.
Right.
And I think that it's really important evidence.
I value it the most. And I'm going to tell you why. Because if we have a study that we could look at, you know, there's some really popular YouTubers out there. They talk about fasting and they only talk about studies. That's someone else's experience. That's in a controlled environment. You don't know what factors weren't being discussed in the study. You only know what they told you. Sometimes studies are manipulated. We know that. So when I started researching research and I started seeing how research could be manipulated, I got a little turned off because there's a lot of politics in journals and being a part of that world. And I felt like I could never really trust the research as much as some people do. So I was like, let me just do my own research. Because if I fast and I'm noticing that I'm losing X amount of weight or I feel really good or my performance at the gym is better, I'm not even really concerned about what the studies say.
Right.
So that was my approach. Now, that's not to say that we haven't had other people do that type of research. My brother's probably someone better to talk to about, he's the one that got the DEXA scans. He's the one that gets the, he had his blood work done. So my brother's a whole nother story. He was over 400 pounds. We started fasting. When we started fasting him, he was like 375 because he had hit a plateau. He started, you know, doing diet, exercise, taking pills and going to the gym, hit a plateau at 375. We started fasting him. His first fast he did was between 10 and 14 days. It was pretty long. Lost a ton of weight. I mean, I think he lost like 40 pounds in like that 10 to 2 weeks period of time. And then we started playing with different fasting methods. We learned a lot. So he was the first person that I noticed when from day 14 to 21, he was losing like four or five inches in a day off his waist, which is insane. It should be impossible. But later on, maybe like a year or so later, he was working and he was into a fast for maybe like, 5 days. And he had to get blood work done. And I think, no. Maybe it was a urine test. It was a urine test and he was dry fasting. So he had to drink water. So he got the test done and he compared those numbers to a test that he had got previously. It was within the same year. And he actually noticed that deficiencies, these are like electrolytes. You know, a lot of people will say that if you fast, you pee out all your electrolytes. So he had deficiencies. He had a couple of electrolyte deficiencies. And he noticed that after the fast, all of the deficiencies were in normal ranges.
Well, that's
and
weird.
All you've been doing is fasting. So We actually find that the body tends to regulate during a fast hormonally. A lot of the things that we're taught don't align with what we're observing. And this is, you know, people, I always want to promote people to do fasting safely. So if you want to add electrolyte to your fast, that's fine. I do recommend that you use something natural, like, you know, obviously a high quality sea salt would be a great option. Or, you know, you could just use some plant material, get yourself a lemon and put it in your water, or some cucumber or some mint leaves or whatever, or even a little bit of fresh pressed fruit juice. I'm a little leery of some of the packets and things that you could buy just because of preservatives and dyes and sugars and things that can go into it. But we have found you don't have to add the electrolytes if you prep and you do your fast properly. So
I was fasting, I would use salt, a good amount of it, and I felt like I needed it. But I also never like pushed myself past a threshold to see what the body does. Like, I think it's foolish to think we just know how everybody is going to respond. And I mean, the body, there is a innate wisdom that doesn't want to die. So it's going to do things that we might not be able to understand or explain or predict.
Yeah. I mean, the body is, I don't, man. One thing that I don't think we talk about enough is, we really generally say that the only way the body's going to get food is, you know, just by taking it by mouth. You're going to eat your food. But when you think about like the cycle of plants through the process of photosynthesis, take in sunlight, they condense that sunlight and they produce the fruit that we eat, you know? So in many different ways, you could actually say that you're eating sunlight. And if you get outside and you allow the sun to touch your skin, especially if you ground yourself, you can get energy through just being outside in the sun. And then, you know, certain breathing exercises can generate energy. So,
yeah, but I would push back a little bit. So I do believe, I have read that they've linked that you can make a small amount of energy from the sun. But if you're breathing, like, there's breathing exercises that can drive stress hormones. Like, if you look at hormones like glucagon and cortisol and adrenaline, one of their jobs is to help increase energy production supply to meet the demand. And they do it by using your body, like breaking down tissue, whether it be proteins or fats, turning the protein into sugar or oxidizing the fat to make energy. So you're going to get energy, but it is coming from somewhere. It's not because you're breathing. It's because you're creating a signal that your body, you're like upregulating that stress response to make more energy,
mm-hmm.
which will feel like energy. It will be energy.
Yeah, it'll
make
is.
ATP.
Yeah.
And maybe over short periods of time, there might be all kinds of like benefits and all kinds of aspects. Yeah, but there comes a point where you have to eat. Like, you, otherwise, you would be able to just go on the breath diet indefinitely.
Well, I mean, you make a good point, and I don't want you to think that I'm trying to state that you never need to eat. But I think that we overeat, and we overemphasize how much we need to eat, and I think we overemphasize the amount of nutrition the body needs to function. And the reason why I say that is because I fasted for 30 days.
Yeah, that's
so
crazy.
It's very hard to tell me that, you know, over X amount of days or whatever, you're not going to be able to function. Not only did I do very long fasts. I mentioned to you earlier, I'm in Texas. And when I was doing my primary fasting, I'm an electrician. We're working outside. We're on the roof. It's summertime. You know, I'm working in schools. When you work in a school in the summer, there's no AC. They're not going to run the AC and nobody's there. So I'm in dusty areas. I was in very poor environments and I'm fasting. And sometimes I'm dry fasting. And
that's insane.
I'm up and down ladders. You know, I'm hauling pipe. So I was able to perform and function at a level that you would think you shouldn't be able to. I should have fell over. But it was fine. Now, don't get me wrong. I noticed that I would get fatigued more easily, but I would just, at the end of the, I would just sleep. It was very interesting.
And no issue sleeping when you're doing a long fast?
So two different things happen when you fast with sleep. Either you're going to get what's called the fasting insomnia, which is where you have a surplus of energy, or you're going to be very tired and you'll notice that you sleep longer. But the sleep is usually pretty restful when you do sleep longer, or at least it is for me. Your water intake is very important for, all of your metabolic functions. When people aren't drinking enough water, they're not hydrating, I should say. Sleep is just not going to be good anyway. But that's the beauty of water fasting, because like you're focused on water. So you're taking in a lot of water. You're not dehydrating the body. So I actually noticed that I started to dream again. Like, go back to when I was 27, 26, 27, I basically didn't dream. And I hadn't dreamed since I was maybe like in my mid-teens.
What do you think that's about, Chris?
Well, they tell us that when you dream every night, right? They tell us you dream every night, you just don't remember it. That's what they told me when I was young. And then I started to learn about the sleep cycle. And getting into the REM state and the deep sleep. And I believe that we're not getting restful sleep. But that's what it boils down to. We're not getting restful sleep. And so therefore, we're not dreaming because we're just not getting there. Or you're getting there, but you're not staying there long. Like a lot of people who track their sleep will notice, when you track your sleep, you can see the different phases of sleep that you're in. And you're in deep sleep for like an hour out of eight hours that you might sleep, which is, I don't know, man, that doesn't sound right to me. So, when I started to hydrate better, my body started to work more efficiently. I was getting into that deep sleep. And then what I noticed was I didn't need as much sleep, which made it all tracks. It's like before I could sleep for 9 hours and still feel like, you just feel like, I didn't get enough sleep. Now I'm sleeping for five, like when I was really fasting, I was sleeping for 5 hours max and I'm ready. So, and I was dreaming,
It's funny. It's an interesting comment you make. Like nobody could tell me that something bad's going to happen if I don't eat, like, cause you have experienced it. But, there's something to that. Like I remember I have a lot of experience in a gym environment working with people one-on-one, and I mean, there was a time where I was into fasting a good bit. And that came out of a pain point for me. I was sick and trying all kinds of elimination diets and just trying to like narrow down what was bothering me. But I remember encouraging people to try fasting just for like 24 hours, just to change their relationship with food, just to understand that like the world is not going to collapse because you go a day. I never recommended anything longer than that. I don't think I was like in a position to do that, maybe ethically or whatever, but it was more like just to break people's as like a pattern disruptor for their mindset, not really like to get healthy, get autophagy, but just to be like, just to learn something about yourself that whatever your belief is about what will happen is probably not true. And it'll make you look at meals. So like if you were in a situation where you feel like you were handcuffed, like you couldn't make a good decision, like you didn't have good options where you were, maybe you were on the road or at a work event or whatever, that if you wanted to skip a meal, like it was okay. Like you were going to be fine.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Most people carry around excess potential fuel on their body that they're not accessing well, due to whatever stress is in their life that's disrupting their metabolic process and their ability to take that fuel and make energy out of it. But like when I look at you, I can only see a little bit of you, but you don't look heavy. You look like a fairly lean guy. In your like physical condition now, what would be your routine now? Like, How long are you comfortable, or how long are you aiming for when you start a fast now, when you're not walking around with a bunch of extra that you're trying to burn off?
All right. So I'm going to tell you, Once again, this is just what this is my experience. I don't recommend this for anybody. I would never teach people this, but when I very first started fasting, I wanted to see what the limits were. I didn't care. I didn't know that it was dangerous. I didn't know you could die. I didn't know that there were that you needed all this food for energy. I was a blank slate. So I'm like, let me just see, right? And I ended up losing 90 pounds. So I started off at 236 pounds, and I got down to like 146 or something. It was pretty crazy. And I'm tall, okay? I'm a very, very tall guy, so...
like what? How tall are you? Give me an idea what I'm...
I'm 6'6".
Okay.
So I was a leaf blowing in the wind. I was at
least... Wait, you were 6'6", 146. Yeah, okay. I follow.
This is the reason why I have the conviction that I have, because I pushed it to the limits. And... Because I kept hearing, people kept telling me, this is dangerous. This is, I don't know. You're just talking to me. I don't know. Like, let me try. Let me see for myself, because people will tell you something's dangerous and they've never even done it. They don't even know. They don't. So, one of my concerns was, if I'm going to share this information with people, there's going to be people that come to me that are slim and they're not trying to lose weight. They just want to heal. Like there's something wrong and they want to use fasting as a tool. Can they safely use it? And so that's what my goal was. And I could tell you that I didn't tip over. It wasn't like I had, like, my energy levels were like just crazy. You know, you probably think, okay, he's hospital ridden. I was going to work. I was, as a matter of fact, I was still making videos at that time. You could see in some of my old videos where I'm just super thin. Like, you could tell, like, this dude's, you know, a skeleton. I was still doing everything. I wasn't super pleased with my physique. And you know, like, I it wasn't, like, appealing to me. But I was fine. And nobody around me was like, dang, Chris, like, you look bad, man. You look sick. Yeah, I looked thin. But it was just like, oh, that's just Chris, whatever. So... they tell you that as long as you have excess body fat, you can fast. You know, people can get very lean. You said you were into fitness and stuff. You know, you got guys getting down to 5%, you know, fat. You can get really, really lean.
Yeah, for a short period of time, yeah. But they also will tell you there's a cost to that, you know. And that may be pushing the envelope too far. I mean, there's a range. And I do think people can exist very healthily within, like, a spectrum. Like, I think I could be 175 and healthy and 215 and healthy, you know, and there's trade-offs on each end. And I think there's actually benefits in each direction. Like, I think if when I'm 175 and I go up to 115, there's benefits along that way, but then there's also different benefits coming back down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is, I mean, I like to tinker and I encourage people to just learn more about their own, you know, N of one experiment by seeing, like, what does happen when you go this way or go that way and find the sweet spot. You know, at 215, I could feel really strong, but really slow. You put me on a track and I'm going to be dog shit slow. But at 175, I might, you know, be fast, at least for me. But, you know, I'm not picking up 300 pounds either. Like, everything feels heavier.
Right.
Like, mobility, like, right now my weight's up a little bit and I feel really strong, but, like, when I do my stretches, I feel like I'm, you know, 10% less flexible, mobile. Gotcha. I value that. Like, I value the sensation of limberness. So it's like, oh, this is probably too much weight. Like, I don't think I'm unhealthy and I need a doctor over it, but I value the limberness more than the 10% additional strength or whatever, especially as I get older. I feel like that feels more valuable to me, to be limber than to be strong. Assuming, like, you're strong enough for what life throws at you.
Right, right. And actually, so I'm not a big fitness guy. I did a lot of experimenting. So I did do some fasted lifting, is what we call it. But my other brother, I've got so many brothers, but my other brother, he actually really is into fitness. Got his fitness certification And he actually did it while he was fasting. He moved to California. I want to say the certification was a few months. And during that time, he used one of our fasting methods. We call it the 5-2, where you would fast for 5 days out of the week. He does water and juice. And then, you know, you eat on your other 2 days. And while he was getting his fitness certification, he was doing that. And so people were looking at him very strange because the way he was building his physique was very different from most people. He didn't have the inflammation. So he always looked really lean. But then when he gets into the gym, he's curling weight that doesn't match his physique. He's able to curl much more weight. So he noticed that when his body is relaxed, he's very limber, he's very flexible. And then when he needs to use his muscle, that's when you see the muscle. His bicep would just pop out of nowhere, and you know, he was able to perform. So we've learned that through, you know, fasted lifting, you really can get very strong. And then what I have personally seen is my gains last longer. You know, like you go to the gym, you're active for 4 months, you step away from the gym for, you know, 5 months or whatever, and you come back and you've lost a significant amount of strength. I noticed that I didn't lose strength nearly as quickly as I did when I was doing traditional diet and exercise versus when I was doing the fasted lifting.
That's interesting. Huh. I remember when I was fasting regularly, there was something noticeable about what I could only attribute it to, like the crushing of inflammation. Like I would feel it in my joints, like a cleanliness that just would appear, and like a restfulness, obviously in the digestive tract, because, you know, it wasn't having to work. But it was very interesting, and I, you know, it became kind of a spiritual practice to me, which, you know, which makes me bring up, like, how I know many religions, if not all, have incorporated some level of fasting into their, I mean, calendar, whatever. I don't know how you would phrase it, into their lifestyle. Yeah. Have you done any like studying on that, the different, like the what's and why's that religions would use fasting over the centuries or millennia?
So I was raised traditional Baptist. So we did fasting like more or less like once a year. Sometimes we would do, if there was some specific thing going on, you know, the Bible teaches you to fast and pray. So, you know, we would fast. We only learned about fasting for spirituality, like, a connectedness to God. And I was a little disappointed later on in life when I found out that fasting had all these other benefits, because as a child, I really didn't understand fasting to become more connected to God. It just did not compute. And so for like traditional, I would say for Christians or at least Baptists, it's more or less, honestly, fasting is used as a tool to, like, if you want to bring new things into your life, or if you want God to rectify an issue in your life, you kind of use fasting as a tool to help enhance that prayer. And then with Ramadan, they do dry fasting, which is different. So like the Baptist church is going to do either water fasting at the most, or they like to do the Daniel fast. The Daniel fast is where it's almost like eating like an alkaline diet. There's certain foods that you can eat, and then like processed foods and certain things you don't eat. But with Ramadan, you do dry fasting, but they only do it from sunup to sundown. So in my opinion, it's actually a lot easier to do the dry fasting from sunup to sundown versus the Baptist fasting, where you might fast for 3 days, or you might do the Daniel fast for a week. And it's a little bit harder. But I think that the reason why all religions have some sort of fasting is because historically, we know that fasting is beneficial holistically, right? It does stave off disease and things of that nature, but it also enhances cognitive function, right? Because that was one of the problems that I was dealing with back then anyway. So you'll see philosophers telling their, you know, if they're teaching, they have students or whatever, hey, you have to fast for X amount of days before you can even come to learn and study under me. It's just one of those tools. I mean, animals fast.
It's by choice, it's just, though? Is there evidence that animals doing that by choice?
I mean, how do you look at a bear hibernating?
Interesting. Right.
And also, if you look at your domestic animals, because domestic animals are a little different from, you know, animals in nature.
They're weird.
They're like us. They're weird, you know.
And they get sick, unlike their counterparts in the wild.
They get very sick, right? I've seen dogs, when they get sick, a dog that eats, you know, you got a dog that likes to eat, he'll get sick, he stops eating.
And what a lot of people could resonate with that. Like, when you're sick, your appetite goes down naturally, and, like, that's probably an important thing to listen to.
Right. Why, though? Right? Why, if you need food for energy, all of the things that we've been taught, why would you lose your appetite when you get sick? At the time,
well, it takes energy to get to assimilate and break down the food and get the nutrients. So you're also allowing your body to shift its, like, resources towards whatever, fighting the infection or whatever you're dealing with.
It enhances your overall immune system. That's the reason why. And that's one of the reasons why we see such amazing healing when we fast, because I have a very different outlook on how the body functions than mainstream. So, but I look at the body as you start off, you have a nice rest, you have 100% charge when you wake up. Before you eat, you're charged. And then you eat, you lose a little charge because your body has to digest. And throughout the day, that digestive process is siphoning off anywhere from, you know, 50 to 60% of your energy. That's the reason why when I was, you know, 28 at work, I'd eat and I'd get sleepy. Thanksgiving is coming up. When you have a nice big meal, you get lethargic.
Well, yeah, you get a bunch of blood that just all goes right to your gut, basically.
Right.
Right.
So, when you're not doing that, well, what's that? What's the body get to do? It was, you know, that energy that would be put towards digesting food can now be used. And like you mentioned, you've got all this extra fuel, right? So when you start fasting, the body starts to utilize ketones. So you can get this energy surplus, this kind of like green energy, the fuel the body really enjoys, and you could like go and work and you could get stuff done. And,
well,
like,
it feels good. I don't know if it enjoys. Like, that's what I'm not sure about. Like, I know I've been in ketosis many times, and I understand that it feels good. And part of me wonders, like, does it feel good because it's just a surge of energy with nature telling you to go out and get food? Because it's like giving you energy, and it's also like gives you focus. Like, you get kind of hyper-focused. And I'm wondering, like, was that just Earth saying this is the mechanism that's built into us to give you enough energy and enough focus to go find food? Or are there other – and I know there's a lot of studies out there on, like, all the other benefits of ketones and this. And I think if you have dysregulated, like, glucose metabolism, yeah, providing a different energy source for your brain so it doesn't have to deal with its broken system is probably great. But also, like you alluded to earlier, like, I'm a cynic of the studies too. Like, when I see a study, the first thing is, like, why does that study exist? Why did someone want to make it? Because what I do see with studies is they're designed generally to show something. Whereas I feel like a good study should be designed to give you a signal if you're wrong, so that if your theory's wrong, you'll know.
That's
not how they're generally designed anymore.
Right.
But so I'm like, I don't know how to reconcile these different systems of and label them like good or bad. I would think that there's some good that's obviously good that exists because it keeps you from dying when you don't eat. You know, it gives your brain something to run on, and it does feel noticeably good.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how to reconcile that with some of the costs associated with it. And maybe there's really no cost until you hit a threshold. And maybe the individual variability that we all, you know, that spectrum that we all exist on is like different for everybody. And maybe the healthier you are, the more you can handle, the more you can push the envelope, or I don't know, or maybe depending upon which system is the healthy or unhealthy system. But it is interesting, like you say, in a historical, like religious context, that there are reasons that they knew that it was generally good. So like it would be incorporated, like, you know, Ramadan. I grew up in a Jewish household, and I think there's a lot of fasts in the Jewish religion. I wasn't very religious, but I knew there was one that I took part in that I knew of. It was Yom Kippur. And it was like, as I understand, and I don't understand much about religion in general, but as I understood, it was like the holiest day of the year. It was the Day of Atonement, and you would fast. And I don't know why, but I liked it.
Mm.
I gravitated towards it. We had, you would kind of lay around, rest all day. We would like take leisurely walks. And it was something to like connect with like my grandfather with, because it was important to him. So he would do it. And I felt like I was, you know, doing something cool with him. And I loved the break the fast. Like I had all these fun foods. Like I loved it. And I would always go too far, you know, because I was a kid. I wasn't like smart about how should you ease back into eating. I was just like a kid. But there must be something else. So it wasn't just for health. Like there's some spiritual thing goes on. And maybe it's similar to the healing that like when you're not allocating resources to the digestive process, you just naturally have more resources to go inward and ponder and reflect and think about your relationship with maybe God or the world or whatever. But
well, if you don't mind, I didn't mention earlier what my spiritual experience was outside of like the church telling me to fast. So one of the reasons why I was fasting was I did want to build a connectedness with who or whatever created me in this world. You know, something that I was seeking at that time. And I noticed that I got more in tune with nature. Like I got really in tune with nature, and I don't know how else to explain it except for I noticed insects. I noticed trees. I noticed birds. I noticed the wind. I noticed the sun. Like, you know, a lot of these things we take for granted. And my thought process towards like creatures changed. Like I didn't want to kill ants if I didn't have to. Like whereas before, if I stepped on an ant, I didn't care. I just didn't care. You know, if I see a bug, a water bug or whatever, you know, I'm not going to purposely step on it. But if I did, I didn't care. No big deal. You know, whereas when I started fasting, I started to watch them. I started to see how intelligent they are. Now, you know, they've got plenty of studies and documentaries on ants and how amazing these creatures are, but I never cared. I never paid attention. So part of like my spiritual experience was connecting to nature, caring more, being observant. And actually I learned from nature. So one of the things that came out of this was eventually I started a garden because, I wanted to eat better and, you know, the grocery store is just everything is full of chemicals and whatever. And I'm like, okay, the only way I can control what I put in my body is if I grow the food myself. So I do a garden and I'm like out in nature and I'm just observing and nature teaches you so much. So like I was trying to figure out how can I garden without having to be out here every single day. And then, you know, I came across this permaculture thing. And I was like, what? How does nature garden? Because if you go to a rainforest or, you know, some place where man was basically untouched, fruit grows, nuts grow, animals eat, everybody eats. And I noticed that what one weird thing we do is when the leaves in the fall hit the ground, we clean them up, we bag them, and we like take them to the dump, right? But in nature, the leaves just collect and then they rot and they break down and they become new soil. And when you look at a forest floor, it's very aerated because it's pine needles and it's twigs and it's all these different sizes and different materials. And there's all this growth and life. And now I learned that from being outside in nature, observing nature, being able to be in tune with nature. And to me, that's spirituality. Like that's a connectedness to God, something that I didn't have before. So, you know, I think because you start caring more about yourself, you also kind of consider others, and others not necessarily being just other people, it's just creatures. You know, like I feel bad for the orchids that are not the orcas that are stuck in the big aquariums, the killer whales or whatever they're called. Like, you just care more. And I'm not a vegan, but, you know, eventually I stopped eating meat because it was hard to source meat healthy. And I just found it easier just to not eat it. And that took me on a whole nother journey. Like, I learned about mushrooms, and there's all these different foods out there that I never ate before that now I really enjoy. A lot of people think that you're restricting yourself when you say, oh, I don't eat meat anymore. But it actually opens a door, because there's a ton of fruit and vegetables out there that you've probably never explored because you've got your favorite five meats that you eat. You know what I mean? So there's just a lot more variety of life out there. You learn, I don't know, like, I start connecting dots that don't connect. Like, I get it why fruit and stuff is wild. Why there's a thousand different varieties of bananas. Because we used to have a banana in the United States. I can't remember the name of it, but it was the one that came before the Cavendish banana. And I guess like a virus wiped out all the crops because they were just cloning the same banana. So, you know, the virus just wiped them all out. When you have variety, a virus could never do that. It could never, because everything's just genetically a little bit different. But also it's like you get different flavors and textures. Like, I had a banana from Miami. It's a little baby banana, and it tastes like a grape. Like, the moisture content had a ton of water, and the sweetness level was way different from the Cavendish banana. I never would have tried that had I still been eating meat. And just having a respect for animals, a little bit different respect for animals, caused me to think differently. I'm like, let me just try some other stuff. So that's all spiritual to me. That's how I look at it.
Gotcha. Well, that's interesting. Well, it sounds like you went on quite the journey, Chris. And it seems like now you're really using that to try to help others that want to explore and be their own anecdotal experiment. Well, let's wrap this up. I really enjoyed this. How do people... So you have a YouTube channel. It's right, called...
So, a Healthy Alternative. Mm-hmm. I've got our primary website is ahealthyalternative.org. And then we have a free membership site. It's kind of like a Facebook group, but basically you can come learn. Look, people come, they're doing carnivore, they're doing keto, they're doing alkaline. Everybody's welcome. Because the goal is, maybe you have a different perspective and you have something unique to bring and share with the greater community. And maybe that piece of information is going to help somebody who's struggling, because maybe the alkaline thing don't work for them. Or maybe fasting water only doesn't work. Maybe it's better to mono fast and you have a different experience. So you guys can find that at ahacommunities.com.
That's great. And I got to applaud you, Chris, because I think, especially in like the world of diet, food, not fads, like tribes, you know, it's tribal. So good for you for like trying to be more community-based or inclusive across those, because it's like dogma, like even within fields, like carnivores be like, you ate fruit, like you're the problem. You're a fake carnivore or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not the answer. Yeah, so that's great that you're doing that. Good for you, man. I appreciate that. Ahealthyalternative.org, is that what you said, is the website? And then you also do some coaching that people could connect with you if they want, I guess?
Yeah, so I do consultations. I have coaches on my team. Everybody kind of offer, they have different packages. It just depends on what you guys are looking for. You could just check it out on the website. And then also we do group coaching, large group coaching, which in my opinion is like the best thing since sliced bread. You've got 500 to 1,000 people who are all on one accord. They're all looking to improve their wellness, whether it's lose weight, reverse a disease, whatever the case may be. And we safely guide you from, let's say, if you're eating a standard American diet, to being able to fast and being able to be successful. And then we share a lot of tools. Like, along the way, I was a purist for a long time, but you know, sometimes a tool helps. We've got herbal teas to help suppress the appetite. We've got things to help to aid the body in detoxification, so you don't get detox symptoms. We got things that can help you lose weight. We have things that help you sleep. And I'm very specific about the types of tools and therapies I recommend. Usually, I've personally used everything and seen benefit before I bring it to the community. Sometimes if one of my coaches sees some benefit, you know, we'll still. But like, these are things that I've personally vetted and I use myself. So we actually have a challenge coming up pretty soon. I don't know, you know, when this will come out, but we host challenges pretty regularly, probably about, you know, maybe once a quarter or twice a quarter. It just depends. So you guys come, if you come and get locked in on AHA Communities or our YouTube, you'll hear about it. We've got a challenge coming up this Sunday.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you reaching out and taking the time. I've enjoyed talking to you, Chris, and maybe I'll get inspired to do another little fast here and there. It's been a while, and I do remember enjoying it. I think I just went a little too far for me, but that doesn't, you know, I don't want that to skew my mindset and like never do it again, you mm-hmm. know?
You should try it with us.
Maybe
see,
I will.
See how
I am going to. Okay, maybe I will. Well, for listeners, always grateful for your listening. I ask you, I mean, if you are out there listening to this and you have something to share about your experience with fasting that could, you know, help out the community or listeners, then I encourage you to leave a comment and tell us what you think about all that or what you've experienced. And Chris, thanks again, and I hope our paths cross again sometime.
Likewise. Thank you.
Have a good day, everybody.